Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 223. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about Red Canyon walls, waterfalls, and whitewater as we go rafting down the Grand Canyon. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into today's interview, I do have a few news stories for you. The first story is about a freakish tragedy that happened recently. A cruise ship was hit by a 30-foot wave, and a few passengers were killed. Now, this sounds like something out of the Poseidon Adventure, and you'd think it would be related to the tidal wave caused by the earthquake in Chile, but it wasn't. It was caused by storms in the Mediterranean just this last Wednesday. The second story is also freakish, but not tragic. A pilot was arrested for flying a 737 with a fake license. Media reports say that the 41-year-old Swedish man was in the cockpit of a Corindon Airlines Boeing 737 preparing to take off from Amsterdam to Ankara, and Dutch police boarded the jet and arrested him on a tip from Swedish authorities. But he had been flying on this fake license for 13 years. Good to know. We check those carefully. For links to both of those stories, as well as This Week in Travel, the weekly travel news show that I do, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show George Wendt, who's coming to us from Oars. And Oars is a rafting outfitting company. What is the right term for the business you're in, first of all, George?
I think you've done it very well, a rafting outfitting company.
And I've invited George to come on and talk about whitewater rafting as a vacation destination, and specifically, we're going to talk about the Grand Canyon. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Chris. Nice to be here.
And I have to admit that the reason why I wanted to do a show about rafting the Grand Canyon is that's one of the places on my list. That's definitely one of the, before I die, I would love to get out on the whitewater on the Grand Canyon. Let me ask you this, first of all, am I wrong? Is that the trip I really should be dreaming about, or is there a better one that people don't know about?
Well, the Grand Canyon, I think, has to be clearly stated to be the best river trip in the world. It's one that is complicated to put into people's time schedule on how to do it. And so not everyone is going to be able to do the Grand Canyon, but it's one that I would guess most people who have thought about doing a raft trip all of their life are going to say, yes, this is the one I'm going to want to do before I get too old and too infirm not to be able to fully enjoy it.
Well, it may be too late for that, but and when you say it's complicated, the two factors that I know, one is the length, that it is a longer trip, and two is that there is a limited number of people who can do it.
Yes, the National Park Service limits the number of participants to about 20,000 a year, which may sound like a fairly large number, but they also limit very carefully the number of people who can go on any given day. And so the season has been stretched pretty much over the period from April through October, and they allow up to four commercial groups a day to go down the canyon, three of them being motorized trips, which travel at a different pace than the non-motorized trips, which is what we do. And so the trips never bunch up. Okay. There's nice spreading.
Okay. And Is the limit then more the season and the per day thing? Do you ever get to 20,000 people going down the Grand Canyon in a year?
The National Park Service probably would say they have hit that number almost every year,
okay,
with a slight drop in 2009, probably because of the economic contraction in this country and in much of the world. And so that demand just a little bit, although many companies, including our own, still filled their individual allocation completely.
Okay. And so preparation, if I wanted to do something like this, I'd need to plan a year in advance. Is that about right?
Most people are reserving about a year in advance.
Okay.
Many companies have recently opened up their reservations for 2011. And so to get the best choice of dates, that's where I would say people would be needing to be doing their planning. That doesn't mean, however, that there aren't some spaces still available for this coming summer, 2010.
Okay. And then you talked about two different types of approaches. Let's do that first. We have the motorized, and then I assume that the rest are oar rafts, or do you also have some where people are passengers and you have the great big oars?
Pretty much as you've described it, motor versus non-motor. The non-motor category, there would be rafts that are rowed, actually some wooden boats called dories that
are individually rowed.
And then there's a smaller raft called a paddle raft that carries six passengers. And that's what a lot of people may think they're going to be doing when they go down the Grand Canyon, is actually going in a paddle raft. And I can explain more about that as we go forward. But about, just for rough numbers, about 75% of the people going down the Grand Canyon on commercial trips go on motorized rafts, which are larger pontoon rafts, pontoons from the old military design that can sometimes be made into bridges where roads get washed out. And they're usually about 33 feet long, and they can typically carry 10 to 15 passengers, whereas the smaller non-motorized boats generally carry just four or five, or at maximum six passengers per craft.
And then you say that the trips are of different lengths, too, that a motorized is faster, is my impression.
Yes, definitely. Because of the engine, which allows the boat to go about twice as fast, a motorized trip can go all the way through the canyon in about 7 or 8 days. And the entire canyon is at least 226 miles long, and sometimes closer to 290 miles long if they go all the way down to Lake Mead. And so the outboard engine does allow them to travel that full distance. Probably an average is about 8 days to go all the way through the canyon. So for people who say, I want to do it, I want to see all of the canyon, they would be in that roughly 75% of the people who would choose a motorized craft.
Okay.
But then we get lots of people who tell us, oh no, I don't want to go on a motorized raft. I want to get the real feel of the river, perhaps a little bit more excitement. And so then they choose to go on our trip, which would be roughly 13 days long to go all the way through the canyon, or they hike in or out at an exchange point in the center of the Grand Canyon called Phantom Ranch.
Okay. And then I was surprised you're saying that they're still using dories. Now, I know that that's what John Wesley Powell used, something similar to that, but that always seemed like a little prone to dashing itself on rocks in...
Well, you've got a very good mental image. You don't want to be smashing these wooden boats into rocks. The reality, however, is that the flows of water in the Grand Canyon are generally sufficient to provide pretty good cushioning on most of the rocks. And so a well-controlled dory, since it is carrying generally just four passengers plus a guide, can actually move around and shift between rocks, and it takes a skilled guide to be able to do that. But although we have some dories that bump a rock, that can cause significant damage very quickly because the boat has a lot of mass and a lot of momentum connected with it. But in general, a dory makes it through just fine, and it's perhaps a little bit more exciting, and it's considered the most authentic way of going down the canyon because of the history with Powell.
Interesting. Now, you've done this trip many times.
I have.
What for you is the highlight?
Just the tranquility of being in this amazingly beautiful place that looks even more spectacular when viewed from the bottom than when people observe it from one of the major points along the rim where they can see the beautiful vistas down into the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And the tranquility, especially of an evening when you get to a campsite and you know that you have this little microcosm that for that moment in time becomes the focus of each person's life. And there's very little thought about what's going on in that outside world out there.
And that's one of the things that's always surprised me as I've talked to friends who have done this trip is you've got tens of thousands of tourists who are lining the rim looking down towards you, if not at you, and yet you're fairly isolated for a week down here on the river.
Amazingly isolated. We can see jets flying overhead, or we can see the vapor trails that they leave behind them, but otherwise no sound from man intrudes down into the canyon, and it's pretty easy to think there's just no one else besides our group and maybe these other three or four groups that you might bump into at some time during the course of the trip. And we can see a very large observation tower on the rim.
Sure.
On the south rim, and it's a real notable viewpoint. I think it's called the Hopi Tower, where the people there do have telescopes trained down on the river, although it would be pretty tough for them to actually see a raft or a boat.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But we sure cannot see any people by looking up there, even with a big set of binoculars.
And do you have a particular favorite point in the Grand Canyon, a favorite place or two?
If I had to pick one of the most amazingly beautiful places, I'd say it's in the area around mile 30 near Redwall Cavern, which is a spectacular amphitheater carved by the river level. And this amphitheater goes back in several hundred feet. Major John Wesley Powell, in his journal, indicated that he thought 50,000 people could be seated in this amphitheater. I'm guessing he might have exaggerated just a little bit, but it is really very large. And it's only by walking from one length of this large amphitheater to the other end does one get an idea of the scale. And you certainly are hundreds of feet back in under the lip of the canyon, which is extending thousands of feet above you. Well, the canyon in this alcove is probably only 50 feet high, or it narrows down to only 10 feet high at the very back of it. But it's a large, beautiful place. And this is in Marble Canyon, which is red in color. The rock is actually limestone, but the staining from rock layers above it produces a beautiful, fairly bright, dark red color. And I would say that area around Redwall Cavern and Vasey's Paradise would be the number one highlight in my mind. And it is, I think, for many, many people who do have the good fortune to go down there.
Okay. And you said you had two.
Oh, well, then Vasey's Paradise is one that's about a mile upstream of Redwall Cavern. And Vasey's Paradise is where a large flow of water, well, large flow of water, meaning quite a nice waterfall, several hundred gallons of water gushing per second out of this hole in the rock where an underground spring brings water that cascades down the bottom part of this red rock. And as nature would have it, where there's water, there's greenery. And so Vasey's Paradise, named after a botanist back in the 1930s, is just covered with beautiful fern and moss and watercress, and is a real oasis in the bottom of the canyon. What some of your listeners might be interested to know is most of the summer, it's pretty hot down in the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And standing in the spray of this water is quite a joy.
And speaking of that, so it's hot in the bottom of the canyon in the summer. In fact, I've been in the canyon one time, I think, when it was 80 at the bottom and snowing at the top. So it was a little earlier on in the season. But in the summertime, we're talking above 100 at the bottom of the canyon.
Quite often, temperatures would certainly get to 100. In fact, during June, July, and August, we tell people the average high for the day will be 103 to 106. And nighttime temperatures typically cool down into the 70s, but 78 starts to feel fairly cool. And since it's almost 5,000 vertical feet up to the rim, there is quite a temperature gradient, as you pointed out, from the time you were there with snow.
Right. But the water temperature is not 100 degrees or 90 degrees or even anything close to that, as I understand.
Very definitely true. The water that is flowing through the Grand Canyon is now controlled by Glen Canyon Dam, which is just upstream of the launch point at Lee's Ferry. And since the water released from the dam is coming out from a midpoint, it's pretty cold. And it comes out in the low 50s. And even during those real hot summer days, traveling 100 to 200 miles down the canyon, the river temperature seldom warms above 56 degrees, so it's cold water. You don't want to go swimming, probably.
And I think that was the surprise when I talked to people who had done that trip, is they talked about you're in the middle of the river and there's no place to stop and you need to relieve yourself, that they were being let into the side of the water and they said, oh, it was so cold.
A little shock.
And speaking of that, so my wife's idea of roughing it, we sometimes joke, is slow room service. This is not her ideal trip. Who are we talking about when we talk about the trip? What do you need to enjoy in terms of a level of roughing it to do this kind of trip?
More than anything else, it's a mental attitude to welcome the unusual kind of experiences. It needs somebody who has some flexibility and who is willing to sleep out. Some of the companies do supply cots for evening sleeping, but most people sleep on a foam pad. Sometimes those foam pads are pretty comfortable because they have foam plus they have air in them, so it's over an inch thick. But the reality is most people end up sleeping on the ground or near the ground.
Okay.
And so it's not luxury accommodations, but typically outfitters do carry folding camp chairs, and the guides are excellent food preparers. In fact, some of them get the name of Chef Bob and Chef Diane. They're really very good in their meal preparation. And so that's a surprise for many people who might think that they're going to lose weight on this trip. Typically, that's not the case. We do take portable toilets on the trip. So those are set up in a private area all the time we're in camp. So really, we take many people who have never camped in their life. We have people from New York City who tell us they've never even walked more than a mile at any time in their life. They find this to be a pretty dramatically beautiful place where they realize they have a lot more ability to handle roughing it than they might have realized.
Well, if you're doing all the cooking, that certainly makes it easier, but...
Well, it makes it pretty luxurious, really.
And you're carrying everything in and carrying everything out, too, as I assume the rules in the park.
We are. And what, again, amazes people is when they see the thick-walled ice chests that we carry, and we can actually keep ice in that hot environment that I've described for a full 13 to 15 days on our trip. Huh. And on a motorized trip, it's pretty easy to keep ice for 7 or 8 days. And so we have fresh fruit, vegetables, meat, fish throughout the course of the trip, and we're not deprived in the menu department.
What is the biggest surprise you've had on one of these trips?
I think it's just the interaction with people, because we do get a very interesting group of people. Typically, trips have two people coming from, let's say, Baltimore, and another small group, one or two or three or four, coming from somewhere in North Carolina, and people from Chicago and Colorado and Texas and all over the country. Most of them are pretty interesting people. Even people who are somewhat shy find that dealing with a group that has an average of 16 to 20 passengers on a trip is pretty easy to get to know people during the course of the trip. Uh-huh. And so we find that people are happy to share, and everybody has a story. And so it's those interesting stories that, for me, make the trip very interesting. I still work as a guide periodically, and just being able to relate with people during the course of time that we've been doing this, and we've been running Grand Canyon trips now for 40 years, I've met, I would say, fewer than 5 people who I would not feel real comfortable inviting to my home, and then realizing I need to go out of town and I could just leave them in my home and know that the house would be well cared for and properly cleaned up after they were done. In other words, real nice people.
Who's the most interesting person you've met?
Well, I guess it would probably be some of the movie people, some of the Hollywood personalities. Jeffrey Katzenberg from DreamWorks
has
come on our trips a number of times. And just the fact that this world in the Grand Canyon is so different than the pressures of life that he's dealing with some pretty complicated projects, I think surprised me that people who maybe are very high in politics or in finance find the tranquility and the adventure of a Grand Canyon trip to be just the perfect therapy for their enjoyment.
Now, you get out of the boats sometimes, other than just camping at night. You're doing side trips up some of the side canyons, hikes and things?
Yes, and it's those hidden gems up side canyons, which I think are very enjoyable for everybody on the trip. And we try to get out of the rafts every, let's call it, hour and a half or 2 hours. That provides a convenient time for people who say, hey, I have to go to the bathroom. And it also provides access up some of these side canyons to see fossils, to see Native American ruins, to see beautiful hidden waterfalls. And there are many side canyons, and that is a surprise, I would say, to most people who are considering a river trip. They would probably never imagine that when viewing the canyon from the top. And even as they set out on a river trip, unless they've done a lot of reading ahead of time, they probably wouldn't know they're going to see these beautiful fern glens and shady nooks that for many people are as good as the river trip itself.
And when you talk about Native American ruins, that'd be Anasazi?
They would typically be called Anasazi, although a more politically correct term now would just be the ancient ones.
The ancient ones, okay.
But they did build their granaries and dwelling structures high up on the canyon walls quite often, where they could be somewhat limited from any danger, either from animal or from other humans.
Okay. But going that far back, not Sinagua or Navajo or something more recent?
Correct. Definitely from about 1112 to 1200 AD.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. What's one warning you would give to somebody to properly prepare them for a trip like this?
I would say it's in the area of skincare. People may not realize that the sun is pretty intense because many people don't go in June, July, and August. They go in April or May or September or October, which are some of the more temperate months, and they fail to realize that the reflection from the water can cause burning just like direct sunlight can. The most unpleasant experience I guess I've witnessed is people getting the tops of their feet sunburned.
Oh, done that. Yep. Okay.
They go out and buy this beautiful new set of sandals or tevas, as they're called, and they forget that the tops of their feet, unless they've been out to the beach an awful lot, are very susceptible to sunburn, and the sunscreen can easily get rubbed off. And so I highly recommend bring an extra few pair of socks. If you're going to wear the sandals, put the socks on for at least 4 or 5 hours a day and protect your feet from getting sunburned. And then make sure you use a good moisturizing cream at night, because the water and dry air, very low humidity, can be quite taxing on skin.
I assume you bring a camera along on the trip, or at least you have in the past.
Most people, I guess, want to do a photographic documentation of their trip. So we get many people bringing quite expensive cameras on the trip. And we tell people, yeah, it's a good idea to have them on your homeowner's insurance. But we do have a nice waterproof way of carrying them, either in a Pelican case or an ammunition box, which has a nice waterproof seal, or specially made neoprene bags that have very good sealing qualities, dry bags. And so those bags can be stowed down in protected areas going through the rapids. But then before the rapid or right after the rapid, they come out, and that's how people get the smiles and the beautiful places captured so they can share it with their friends.
And what are your three favorite places to take pictures? Three favorite pictures of the canyon.
One of them would definitely be in the area of Red Wall Cavern.
Okay.
That's a very special place. Then I would say down in the area around Havasu.
Sure.
Havasu is down on the
towards the end,
second part of the trip past Phantom Ranch. Typically turquoise blue water there, framed against the red rock, gorgeous pools, and greenery. And so you get those colors all making quite nice contrast. And then you get the people who you now have spent some time with and probably have got to know fairly well. Those make good photo images. And then I'd say one other favorite place would be Deer Creek Falls. When I first went down the canyon, they didn't have guidebooks back then. It just was such a surprise to, in a sense, be floating along the river, not knowing that Deer Creek Falls was going to be dropping this 130-foot stream of water almost directly into the river. It can be into the river at high water flow, although now it's usually a short distance from the river, but you can see it right from the river. That's just beautifully framed. A large volume of water comes out of Deer Creek.
If I can't get on a Grand Canyon trip, what's your second favorite place to go whitewater rafting?
It is in Dinosaur National Monument. Dinosaur National Monument is partly in Utah, partly in Colorado. It's right on the northwest boundary of Colorado and the northeast corner of Utah. Beautiful country. Red Rock Canyon, which in many ways is similar to that in the Grand Canyon, although in general it's more of a maroon or purples work into the rock coloration up there. It's at higher elevation by about 2,500 feet, so it's a little cooler than the Grand Canyon. And the trips at Dinosaur are 4 or 5 days in length. And so that makes it easier for many people who say, I don't want to go for 7 nights or 13 nights. And they want to try it out. And it has another major advantage. Well, 2 major advantages. One is it is a lot more affordable than the Grand Canyon because it's just a 4-day trip. And the rapids are smaller than those in the Grand Canyon. They rate an average class 3, okay, which is medium, which means we can take a 7-year-old there. In the Grand Canyon, for our trip, we have to set a minimum age of 12.
So the class 4 rapids in the Grand Canyon then?
Class 4 and even some class 5.
Oh, okay.
And they're big rapids in the Grand Canyon. They're not continuous by any means. The rapids are maybe only every 2 or 3 miles. But when you get to a rapid, it can be quite formidable. And I had one man call me just the other day. He had seen the National Park series on PBS recently. Ken Burns, I think, is the one who put that together. And he asked me how rapids were formed. And it was a fun little conversation just explaining that rapids are formed in the Grand Canyon and on the Green River in Dinosaur National Monument, where boulders have been washed out of the mouth of the canyon by a flash flood. And then the river has to cut a channel around and over the top of those rocks. And that's what actually creates a rapid. And in Dinosaur National Monument, the rapids are somewhat smaller, average class 3, which makes them much easier for a family.
Okay. So Dinosaur is the Green River. I was going to ask that. So that's the headwaters then of the Colorado.
Correct. It is the Green River, as you've just said, and the Green River does flow into the Colorado River then. Okay. And so eventually that water gets down to the Grand Canyon after a long trip.
And then just for people who aren't aware of the 6 classes of rapids, basically when we talk about them being class 5, that's largely the most dangerous rapids that commercial guides will go, because 6 is danger to life and limb, as I understand.
Correct.
Okay.
Few people would ever willingly take on a class 6. That would be a major waterfall, which has high probability of injury or death. And so few people, except in the Grand Canyon, even run class 5 rapids. But a very adventurous person might do a class 4 rapid, and somebody who is perhaps even fearful of water could generally do a class 3 rapid. And that's something I might just mention. We found many people doing our trip in the Grand Canyon and other places tell us, I don't know how to swim. And we tell them, well, that really doesn't matter, because we supply the personal flotation device, commonly known as a life jacket.
Right.
And that's going to take care of you if you do fall in the water.
Fall in the water, point your feet down river and float.
Exactly.
No, I've been in class 4 rapids is probably the biggest I've done. I haven't done class 5, and I don't ever intend to do class 6. So,
okay, well, just do class 5. There are a few of those in the Grand Canyon, like Lava Falls and Crystal Rapid are 2 of the biggies in the Grand Canyon. But people, by the time they get to those points, are pretty comfortable generally in their abilities. The ability of their guides, who are very key in having a safe run through these rapids. And also they have confidence in their craft because they realize the boats are pretty stable. And if they just hold on, they're going to likely get through just fine.
Now, you mentioned earlier about how much momentum the raft can have. What is the fastest speed the raft gets to?
It varies depending upon the flow of the river.
Sure.
But in general, with the flows released from Glen Canyon Dam, the river flows between 3 and 4 miles an hour. When the river actually gets to a rapid, it tends to speed up, very much like going through a constricted Venturi
right.
tube might be. And so then I would say 9 miles an hour might be a fairly fast flow going through a rapid.
Okay. I just am reminded because I've been caught by surprise with how fast the raft is moving, doing some, in this case, very tame whitewater rafting on the Sacramento River near Sacramento, where the last person in the raft fell out because he thought we were going too fast, so he reached up and grabbed a branch to try and slow us down. And now he is out of the raft. He was so fast that none of the 5 people in front of him noticed, and the person in front of him turned around and said, "Oh, Mike has fallen out of the raft. I should slow us down." So he reached up and grabbed a branch, and now he's out of the raft. And I was the one in front of them, and I looked around, and there were 2 people in the water, and I thought, "Oh, we're going too fast. I should slow us down." And literally half of us made this bad decision one after another as we tried to slow down the raft and just didn't realize how rapidly we were going. And we weren't in anything like the Colorado River. So,
well, I like that, how rapidly you were going. Very good. Well, remember, be careful. And that applies not only to branches that you might reach up to try to grab to slow yourself down, but that's a written rule that you never try to step out of the raft while the raft is moving.
Right,
because
sure.
You can get caught in rocks at the bottom of the river. The river current is quite strong, so you never want to stand up. You always
right.
want to just float right into the edge where you're able to just paddle your way right up onto the shore.
As we go to wind this down, finish this sentence for me. You really know you're rafting the Grand Canyon when what?
When you feel that exhilaration, the raft speeding up, and you know that the tongue which you're going on through this rapid leads you right into the large tail waves, which produce the largest up and down motion and the exhilarating feeling that we've made it through another rapid. We probably got a little benched by the spray of the rapid, and there is an exhilaration that I think is truly unduplicatable. It's not scary like a roller coaster because, number one, it's going much slower and you're not going down real steep hills like on a roller coaster, mm-hmm. but there is a feeling of just pure joy that has been lots of fun to share with many people over the years.
And then if you had to summarize the Grand Canyon in 3 words, what 3 words would you use?
Tranquility,
okay.
beauty, excitement.
Excellent. George, thanks so much for coming on the show. And again, if people were wanting to go with you down the Grand Canyon, where would they find your website?
They'd find it under just our company name, which is Oars. 4 letters, O-A-R-S, as in Sam, oars.com.
Great. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Chris. Nice talking to you.
I have one internet resource for you today, and that is Briefcase to Backpack. Briefcase to Backpack is a blog. It is a multiple-person blog by Sherry Ott, Michaela Potter, and Michael Bontempi. And you may recall Sherry as someone who has been on the show before talking about doing solo travel as a woman. And Briefcase to Backpack is a site where you can get resources and advice on how to leave your day job and go out and do some traveling, whether that be for a short term or a major career transition. So check that out, briefcasetobackpack.com. I got an email from Brian who writes, "I remember that you traveled a lot in Europe. I'd be interested in reading about places that are off the beaten tourist path and less well known that still have cultural importance or natural beauty. Are there any small cathedral towns, museums, hiking trails that you especially enjoyed that few people know about? Tips on how to save money in Europe are always welcome too." I wrote back to Brian, one of the experiences that we had, we were traveling in Germany a number of years ago, probably 22 years ago or so, and had what I believe was a Michelin map, and that map had all of the cathedral towns marked. And so we were driving up the Autobahn and saw this little town that we'd never heard of, wasn't in the guidebooks, called Fritzlar, that had a cathedral. And so it was about the time we needed to stop. We pulled off, and Fritzlar is a gorgeous little town. We didn't run into anyone who spoke English at all. This is how far off the tourist path we were, even in the hotels and the restaurants. But it was just gorgeous. We actually came home with a watercolor print of Fritzlar that was on our bedroom wall for years. So that's one tip on how to find those. I'm interested in your tips also. I've started a post on the Facebook fan page that I'm looking for solutions for Brian, especially little tiny museums that we never would have heard of or hiking trails that are good. And if you have something good, you might also be interested in doing a blog post for the Amateur Traveler. I'm trying to encourage more people to submit blog posts. I'd love to see your writing and hear about your travels as well. And speaking of your travels, don't forget we are doing that travel photo contest. The winner will win a copy of Ralph Velasco's book on travel photography. Ralph will be the judge of that. And that's going on in March. And you submit your photos again through the Facebook fan page, which is facebook.com/amateur traveler. Speaking of Ralph, don't forget to sign up for the Egypt photography tour that Ralph and I are doing in November. You can do that at amateurtraveler.com/tours. This is my second episode that I'm putting together this week because I'm going to be in Hong Kong next week. So by the time you hear this, I'll probably already be back. But because of that, I'm going to bring this to a close here. I'd like to remind you this show is part of the Travelcast Network. Check out travelcast.com to find other interesting travel shows. Remember, there is an app for the Amateur Traveler that would work on your iPhone. And I know some people who just really enjoy that. If you're interested in advertising this show, that would be a great help. And don't forget that if you join the newsletter before March 18th, then you will be entered automatically to win Fodor's Israel. With that, we'll bring the show to a close. If you want to send me an email, send it to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. Again, join the Facebook fan page or follow me on Twitter at Chris2X for lots of information or Amateur Traveler for just the show-related information. As always, thanks so much for listening.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.